from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the program, the winner of a high school essay contest inspired by the phrase, "War is a racket." Also, Gas Hole, a new documentary about oil prices and alternative fuels. First, why do some people help strangers while expecting nothing in return? More remarkably, why do some people put themselves at great risk to help others they don't know? An expert on altruism visited Sacramento today to talk about her research. Kristen Munro is a professor of philosophy and political science at UC Irvine. She studied altruism for many years and has written two acclaimed books on the subject. Her speaking engagement today was at Sacramento State. Kristen Munro stopped by our studio this morning, and I asked her to give us some examples of what counts as altruistic behavior.
Well, altruism is an interesting phenomenon because it can be just very simple helping someone, from sharing, cooperating, on up to doing things which are really risking your life to help someone else. When I did The Heart of Altruism, I interviewed people who were philanthropists, since that's a form of altruism, in which you give away a lot of money. You don't give away all of it, though, so you still take care of yourself. I also interviewed people who were members of, had gotten the Carnegie Hero Commission Award. These are people who are not firemen or policemen, so they're just ordinary people, and they do things like jump into waters and save people from drowning or go into burning buildings and help them. And about a third of the awards are given posthumously, so there is some risk to their lives. And then the last group I interviewed were people who had rescued Jews during the Holocaust, when there was not only risk to themselves, but also to their families, because if they'd been caught, they would have been killed.
How do people get that way?
Well, that's a big question, isn't it? There's a lot of discussion about that. There are lots of different explanations, from the kind of sociocultural things that people, social scientists, love to focus on. People argue that religious people might be more altruistic, that better educated people are going to be more altruistic. It's been said that women tend to be more altruistic than men. When I looked at the people whom I interviewed, I did not find those phenomenon. Those characteristics seem to work sometimes, but not always.
So what did they have in common?
I thought it was a psychological process, the way they saw themselves in relation to other people. It's really identity. It's who you think you are. The sense of who you are, it sets a menu of choices for you, in the same way that if you go into a Japanese restaurant, it's really hard to get good Italian food. So that the people's sense of who they are, their identity, and how they see themselves in relation to other people has a lot to do with how they treat them.
So how do they see their relationship with other people that guides them, that leads them to doing altruistic things?
Well, where you and I would see a stranger, an altruist would see another human being, just a fellow human being. They see themselves as tied to everybody else through bonds of a common humanity.
Don't we all see at least some strangers as fellow human beings?
Most of us do, but not always. Probably if you or I were walking down a street and it was dark and we saw a large, tall, kind of scruffy-looking male coming towards us, we would be a little more nervous than if we saw a young child coming towards us. Altruists, I don't think, make that kind of distinction particularly.
My guest is Kristen Munro. She's an expert in altruism. She spoke about her research today at Sacramento State. She's a professor of philosophy and political science at UC Irvine, and her books include The Heart of Altruism, Perceptions of a Common Humanity, and The Hand of Compassion, Portraits of Moral Choice During the Holocaust. Well, how did altruists get this way, where they see strangers as fellow human beings? Is this something they were born with or something they learned?
I think that it can be both. I think that there are many routes to being an altruist. I use the example of going to see a family reunion, so that the family reunion is in St. Louis. You start out in California. I start out in New York. We all have to get to St. Louis in order to get to the family reunion. So that some altruists may simply be born that way. I'm prepared to believe there were some people I interviewed where I couldn't figure out anything other than that they just were born that way. Others have religious training that was very important for them. Others had socialization. They had parents and teachers who told them you have to be a good human being, you have to help people carry their bags, things like that. So there are lots of different factors from duty, religion, which are trigger mechanisms. But I think what they have in common is that they trigger this particular way of looking at the world.
Does it make a difference whether or not it was something that was a person was born with, as opposed to something that they were trained to do or learned how to do?
I don't think so. But you will find other analysts, excellent scholars, Sam and Pearl Olinor, for example, have a book called The Altruistic Personality, and they talk about the kind of socialization patterns that go on so that you become the habits of caring and it becomes second nature to you.
I've heard that it's very common in humans to see people who in one way or another resemble us, either because they live in our neighborhood or because they're the same color skin or whatever, that we tend to see them less as strangers as we do people who are much more different from us. Does that mean that there is a sort of lower level altruism where we see people who are like us not as strangers?
Well, I think of altruism, I think of people as on a continuum, so that you find some people who are hardly ever going to do an altruistic act, some people who at the other end of the continuum will frequently do altruistic acts, but most of us lie somewhere in between. And so we may have an average behavioral point, but that the variation around that may be quite great. And so you have to look at what it is that might evoke certain parts of your personality. That's where the kind of social psychological analysis is very useful, because we know that people can be encouraged to behave one way or another according to the stimulus that they have from the external environment. And one of the factors that often comes in to play is how you view the other person, so that if the other person draws forth something from you because you had a common maybe you went to school together, or maybe they're both mothers. I had a friend whose father was Jewish, was a Russian Jew, and was put at the end of the line by this German soldier who was taking him in. And when they ran around the corner, the soldier stopped and said, "Get the hell out of here." He remembered him from having played soccer. So that was a tie which was there, and that caused him to see the humanity in him and push him away and save his life. So I think that's one of the more fascinating aspects of studying human behavior. What is it that causes someone to sometimes behave one way and other times behave another?
But isn't that a selective kind of altruism? I mean, doesn't that go against the spirit of altruism if it's going to be triggered by the fact that, you know, you went to the same school as someone?
I think that altruism is not just something. I mean, it's not like it's not that you're born an altruist or you're not born an altruist. It's not a bifurcated variable. We tend to talk about it that way because it's easier. But in reality, I think you really have to think of it on a continuum, and you have to realize that people slide along that continuum at different points. I love the example of Oskar Schindler, who both before and after the war was not a particularly admirable human being, according to his own, you know, description. But during the war, he did an extraordinary thing. What was it that caused him to see the humanity in those particular people and to take the risks for them?
You're referring, of course, to his saving, I believe, hundreds of Jewish people
during the war. Yeah,
he saved
about 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Most people would say that altruism is a good thing. Mm-hmm. But can it become dysfunctional? If you are altruistic all the time, then aren't you going to get suckered?
That's a great question, too. My husband at one point said to me, "Do you want our children to grow up to be altruists?" And I said, "Well, yes and no, I guess. You want them to think of other people, but you have to think of yourself also." So I don't have a good answer to that question. I think the world is probably a better place if you have a little more altruism than we have now. But I think that it's a very difficult question to work out.
Do you know how altruistic people make the decision whether or not to do something altruistic?
They don't make a decision, according to what I found. That was the thing that was very striking to me. I kept asking people, because I'd been trained as a rational choice theorist, which is the theory that basically underlies contemporary economics, that people will make decisions based on their rational calculation of what's better for them given information and opportunity costs. And so I assumed that people made choices. And I would ask these people, how did you decide to save these people? What was it that went through your mind? And they kept looking at me with this kind of confused look, like, "Well, what are you talking about? There really wasn't a decision to make." And that was when I realized I had to kind of throw away the conceptual apparatus I'd gone into the project with and realize that people were simply different, that they had, they really didn't have a lot of choice over what to do.
So what does that say about altruism and being rational? Is altruism rational or irrational?
I think a better way to express that would be, is human behavior rational or irrational? And I think that for me, human behavior is very, after doing this study, now I've been studying this since 1988, I'm convinced that character is much more important than we think it is, that identity precedes action, precedes choice, so that I sometimes tell my students that the verb is probably a more powerful verb than do. You have to be somebody before you can do something. And the sense of who we are really limits the range of choices that we find, not just morally, but empirically. An example that I use is if you were at a conference and you're out of town, you don't know anybody, you're wandering around before you have your afternoon meeting, and someone mugs you. They've beaten you up. They've taken all your money. What would you do to get back to your hotel to get some help? You're far away. You don't know anyone in the town. I would guess that you would probably not think of mugging somebody to get money. Why not? You know empirically that people mug people to get money because it's just happened to you. But you wouldn't do that because that's not the kind of person that you are. You don't see yourself as somebody who mugs other people. You probably would try to find a policeman, or you might ask a stranger. But the sense of who you are will limit the range of options that you see available to you. And I think this happens in all kinds of areas. It's not just concerning altruism. I think it happens in all kinds of things. I see this with students. They come in. They don't think that they're capable of doing certain things. Somebody has to show them that they can do something. You open up a range of possibilities for them that they didn't see before. That's a lot of what education is all about. So I think that the sense of yourself and who you are and what people like you do is very powerful. We're just beginning to understand that, I think, the importance of that ethically.
My guest is Kristen Monroe. She's an expert on altruism, and she spoke about her research today at Sacramento State. She's a professor at UC Irvine. Is it altruism if you're doing your job or if you make money while you're doing it? For example, are firefighters being altruistic when they jump into a building and save a kid who's in a fire? I mean, it is their job, and they're being paid to do it.
Yeah. Traditionally, you don't class those people as altruists because that is their job. The job description, though, is something that they certainly has caring overtones to it. They want to care for other people. And so in that sense, it's altruistic-like behavior.
You interviewed several groups of people in your research, and one of those groups was entrepreneurs were among those people. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose to include them? Aren't entrepreneurs people who set out to make a lot of money?
They are people. And I was looking for baseline data, the term that social science would use, normal people who are not altruists. Because one of the things you want to look at, if you go in and you just study a particular group, you may find something. And in fact, you think that that's an interesting explanatory variable for why those people operate the way they do. But if you don't look at another group that doesn't have that characteristic, you don't know, but maybe everybody does that. They've done it, you know, a lot of scientists have had problems with that, with disease, for example. I mean, the first IQ tests were done, and actually I think they looked at Irish, and they looked at, I don't remember what the other group was. It was done in England, but they never looked at the kind of standard group. They just assumed that there was a normal distribution. In fact, there isn't a normal distribution. Things don't work that way. So you have to have what they call a control group in order to see what's going on with people who don't have the characteristics. So again, I conceptualized this as a continuum, and I thought that entrepreneurs would be people who would be close to the self-interested end of the continuum. They would be people who primarily were driven by what they thought was best for them. And in fact, one of the entrepreneurs that I interviewed had just given away $1 million anonymously. He didn't want anybody to know about it. So I sort of moved him up to the philanthropic part of the continuum. But that, again, is interesting because pretty much everybody has given away some money at some point. I don't think there's anybody in the world that hasn't done something nice for someone.
Does it have to hurt a little bit before it's altruism?
Well, that, again, scholars argue a little bit about. That's one of the definitional components that is most hotly debated. Does it have to have some risk to your own welfare? Usually people say that what's important is intention. You have to intend that it help somebody else. In fact, if I try to help you across the street and you didn't want to cross the street, that may not be an altruistic act, but my intention was good. If I introduce you to somebody I think you're going to like and you fall in love and have a miserable marriage and get divorced, that's not really my fault. My intention was still good. So they usually say intention. It has to actually be an act. You can't just have good intentions. Well, I'd like to do something nice for somebody, but I never get around to doing it. And then there has to be primarily thinking of the other person. There may be unintended consequences to you, so that I may do something nice for you, intending to help you. An example, a roommate and I were in, we were looking at one of the National Trust museums, little shops, and we saw a little Beatrix Potter birthday book, and we both really liked it, and I insisted she take it. I said, no, you take it. There's only one. So I said, you take it. You want it more than I do. She gave it to me for my birthday. Well, I intended that to be a nice act for her. She turned around and did something nice for me, but that didn't lessen the altruistic aspect of my action. And then the last part of altruism is usually whether or not there's any sacrifice to the altruist's welfare. And that analysts disagree on. I tend to think there usually has to be the risk of some sacrifice, but doesn't always have to be there.
In the course of studying altruistic people, have you learned anything about selfish people?
Yes, actually. The book that I'm doing now is on, I've wanted to look at the rescuers. And what I found was that they had such a strong altruistic perspective. This was so important, the way they saw themselves in relation to the world. And I started just by chance talking with some bystanders, people who had not done anything. And I was very struck by the similarity of the phrases. The rescuers would say, when I'd ask them why they did what they did, the rescuers would look at me, very confused, bewilderment, and say, but what else could I do? They were human beings like you and me. The bystanders, when I asked why they didn't do anything, would look at me and say, but what could I do? I was one person alone against the Nazis. And so I thought that was very interesting, that both the explanations they gave were so similar, no choice, and very different perception of themselves. And so I thought, maybe what I've tapped into with the altruistic perspective is part of a broader ethical perspective that everybody has, including people whose ethics are not what we would think of as very highly developed or can think of other people. So I've done interviews with bystanders and with some Nazi supporters. And what I found is that everybody does, that the way you categorize yourself and see yourself in relationship to others is really very important. Mm-hmm. Kind of worldview that you have. The Nazi supporters tended to see themselves as people without a lot of choice, pushed along by the winds of history. They saw themselves as victims, which was really surprising to me. They tended to view Jews, gypsies, social democrats, all the other peoples that were discriminated against, as people who were the way you and I would view a cockroach that comes into our house. We would probably kill it, and we wouldn't worry if it was a baby cockroach or not. And it's very interesting. This was brought home to me by my daughter I was pregnant with her. We were just moved to Irvine. I was in the garden reading a book on genocide. I was doing a review article on several books. And balancing the book on my huge stomach, since I was about 8 months pregnant at that point, my husband came along, was picking up the snails and was putting them in a plastic bag. And I said, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm getting rid of the snails because they were eating all our flowers. And as you know, Southern California gardens come on trucks, and we were in a new neighborhood and our garden had come first, so the snails were happy there. And I heard myself say, oh, don't do that. That's just put them out of their misery right away. And I'd been reading this book about the German health officials and the arguments that they had. Do we put these people in the ghetto and let them die naturally, which is what my husband was going to do by putting them in plastic bags and letting them suffocate? Or do we treat them more humanely by killing them right away, which is what I was arguing? And so I've been reading these articles, this book. And so I said to him, can we think about this a minute? So we decided we wouldn't kill the snails. Okay, fast forward about 2 years. I came home, found my 2-year-old daughter outside in the garden, bringing in all her snail friends and putting them on the glass window that we had going out into the garden. I said, what are you doing? I'm bringing my snail friends in. And I thought, okay, I really don't like snails. I think I'm kind of slimy and disgusting. She thought they were friends. So that night, we explained to Chloe that the snails might be a little hot inside the house because the heat might go on, and so they might be able to open the door and go back out into the garden themselves. And I took all these disgusting snails and put them back out in the garden. But Chloe thought they were wonderful. So the way she categorized the snails was one way. The way I categorized them was another. And then about 5 years later, she did a science project on snails, and she wanted to see whether or not they would travel differently over certain surfaces. And she and I were working on it. My husband had a business dinner, and he came home, and we said, oh, how was your dinner? Oh, it was fine. He said he had great escargot. And oh, Chloe said, what is escargot? And I looked at him, and he said, snails. She said, you ate snails? And I said, okay, here in this family, we have one rescuer, one bystander, me, and one perpetrator. He was willing to eat the snail. So I think that's just a very, you know, kind of hopefully charming and homey illustration of how the way you see things really is different. I mean, it's very interesting. I talk to, again, when you have children, you have to explain things in different terms. But I explained to my daughter and my sons, you know, that 200 years ago, I mean, women didn't have any rights. Black people were in chains. We would think this is bizarre. I'm prepared to believe that, you know, our attitude towards animals is shifting so that, you know, I may have a great-great-grandchild who says, can you believe grandma put a chain on a dog and walked him down the street? I mean, how bizarre. So we're, you know, our attitudes really shift. And certainly people, if you look at the animal rights movement, I think that's an interesting area where they're quite different attitudes. And people will have to the being. Is it a sentient being? Is it like us? And if you put it in the same category, then it's hard to mistreat it. If you classify it as like you, then I think it's more difficult to say, well, they don't get to vote, or they don't get to own property, or whatever it is. And I think that there's a categorization process. And certainly the genocidalists that I've interviewed, the few that I've talked with, there's a kind of distancing that comes, and then it's them, not us. And then they are dirty, they're, you know, whatever.
You can do what you want to them.
You can do what you want to them. Then.
Mm-hmm. Kristen Munro, expert on altruism. She spoke about her research today at Sacramento State. She's a professor of philosophy and political science at UC Irvine. Her books include The Heart of Altruism and The Hand of Compassion. Kristen Munro, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me to come.
Coming up in the program, the winner of a high school essay contest inspired by the phrase, war is a racket. This is Insight from KXJZ. This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. A former Marine Corps Major General once said, war is a racket in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. The Sacramento chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility was taken by that and made that sentence the theme of its annual high school essay contest. Yesterday, a judging panel met and made its decision. Joining us is the young man who took first place. He's Dennis Zhang. Dennis, welcome.
Thank you.
And you are a senior at Granite Bay High School, correct?
I am.
Very good. What was your reaction to that statement that Major General Smedley Butler made about war?
Well, it kind of took me aback for a second, just with obviously my generation is kind of being brought up in this environment where we're taught to think about, we're seeing war on television all the time. But the quote really kind of brought it home for me, because as in high school, my senior year, I've been taking economics, and just the quote, when it was translated into the whole business economic sense, that really struck me, like, while war, when you look at it from this angle, then you can see there's clearly that dichotomy between profits and losses, and it's a different sort of business in which humanity is getting torn apart. And so I really found it to be thought-provoking in that sense.
Had you thought about war in general and the current war in those terms before you started thinking about it in these terms for the essay?
I really hadn't, I don't think, because, sure, I mean, my generation were bombarded with, always on television, you know, smart bombs and images of terrible ravages of war. But when I think the quote just really got me thinking that, you know, there's something going on behind here. Perhaps a lot of the decision-making that goes into war is profit-motivated, is motivated by something other than just fighting for your country.
My guest is Dennis Zhang. He's a senior at Granite Bay High School. He's the winner of this year's high school essay contest sponsored by the Sacramento chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. I'd like to hear you read a portion of your essay. And, well, here it is.
It is imperative that CNN, Fox News, even The Daily Show, emphasize that whatever progress is made, whatever ground is gained or lost, everything is a direct result of people. People just like you and me, on either side of the conflict. This context, whether in terms of an individual soldier or a regiment of passionate young men and women, adds a shade of gray to the black and white world of us versus them. It maintains a certain sense of humanity in the altogether inhumane pursuit that is modern warfare. Being able to understand the other side's motivations, culture, and mindset is an invaluable art, seemingly giving way in this day and age to a more business-focused point of view. No one will ever be able to completely separate money from political decision-making, as the two go hand in hand, or as some might say, hand in pocket. Yet strides must be made towards a more humanistic point of view. Take the time to speak with the veteran, send a care package overseas, or do some research on the history of the Middle East. Each brings us one step closer to finding a worldview not centered solely on the price of oil.
Dennis Zhang reading from his winning essay, inspired by the statement, "War is a racket." Also with us is one of the judges of this year's high school essay contest. She's Catherine Jeffrey, also president of Sacramento City College. Catherine, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Why did the judges decide that Dennis's essay should take first place?
The essays were judged on five categories: originality, clarity, cohesiveness, overall impact, and the oral presentation. Also, each individual was asked a question that was directly linked to their essay. It was something that they were not able to prepare for in advance. So Dennis was selected because on these various points, his overall rating was higher than the points achieved by the other contestants. Also, for Dennis, his response to the question was very strong, showing that he was able to take the knowledge that he had gained in researching the topic and really turn that into a response that indicated his depth of understanding about the relationship between economics and war, and the particular war that we're engaged in now in the United States, with the United States and Iraq.
Dennis, do you remember what the question was?
It involved nuclear war. It was a quote by Albert Einstein. I think it basically it said that despite all of man's advancements in technology and everything, his way of thinking is still relatively crude. And I mean, obviously Einstein is pretty qualified to kind of make such a statement, but really when you think about it, we have so many different ways we could blow up the world 100 times over, but are the people leading any world nation, has their way of thinking evolved along with that technology? We have so many great new toys to play with, but it seems like we've kind of been lacking in the instruction manuals for those toys.
Catherine, you and the other judges had a list of criteria that you had to judge by, but what did you personally, as the president of a local college, what did you come in hoping to hear and to see?
I came in hoping to hear, number one, that the contestants were not just reading words off of a page where they were reading a prepared script. I came in wanting to hear some feeling as they read through their essays, which to me would help communicate that they really understood the words that they were reading, that it meant something to them more than just an opportunity to earn some additional money to pay for their college. In the case of Dennis, as with the other readers, I found that these young people had indeed processed the information. They spoke with emotion as they talked about lives lost, about the consequences of war. In one case, a young man had lost his father, so he in the recent war. So for him, it was a very personal experience to write this essay. In the case of Dennis's essay, he started out quoting statistics that related to the cost of the war, the amount of time that people had spent in being engaged in the war from the beginning up to now. He talked about the number of people, the casualties lost on both sides for the United States and for the Iraqis. So the statistics were very sobering and put, I think, the rest of his essay in perspective.
Dennis, you're pretty much of an age that could be fighting in Iraq or Afghanistan. How do images and news about the war resonate with you? When it started, you were probably, 13 or so?
Yeah.
And now you're at an age where you could be one of those people there.
Obviously. Definitely when you're going through high school and you're seeing all this stuff in the media and the news, and you think to yourself, well, that could be me in a few years. And then your next thought is, well, I'm moving to Canada. But despite that, me and my classmates, everyone around me, this definitely is such a relevant topic, and that's kind of why it made, writing the essay a little bit easier, just thinking to myself, what if I was one of the young men sent out there, sent overseas, and when you're confronted with that image of having your future kind of get taken down that road, I think that makes it extremely even more powerful. And it's a motivation to do things like this, to talk about it, go into college and get out and vote and run for office and everything like that when it has such a personal stake in your life.
Catherine, thinking about all the essays that you saw, was there anything that you wished you'd seen more of? And if you were to do this again next year or some future year, what you would hope young people would write about more, think about more?
Well, in terms of content, the topic is determined by the Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Yeah.
And the topics, I believe, over the last several years of this particular competition have had to do with ways to make the world more safe, ways to prevent war, to create a less toxic environment, or ways to reduce gun violence. That's kind of their focus. What I would hope, I would hope that individuals who decide to write and compete would come in with the expectation, number one, that they're actually writing about something that affects all of us, something that will potentially affect the quality of our lives, and understand that this is, again, not just a competition. The other thing that I would expect is that when people are writing, that they actually take the topic and write in a cohesive and a connected fashion, so that those of us who are judges don't have to struggle to make sense of the entire essay, because in some cases the writing, and this is a technical issue, a technical point, the writing should probably have been reviewed to determine whether or not the point they were making at the beginning was in fact brought together in the summary statement at the end. So just the sense of cohesiveness throughout the document.
Well, that definitely was not the case with Dennis's essay.
That was not the case with Dennis. Dennis had the clarity, the original concept, the way he focused from beginning to end, and the overall impact, how the audience was left feeling after he read his essay. Mm. All of that hung together to clearly have Dennis emerge as the top essay.
And Dennis, you're a senior at Granite Bay. Where are you going next,
I had to commit just like Thursday of last week, I think. I'm going to be going to Harvard in the fall.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
To study what?
Well, one reason that I got into this contest was it's by the Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I believe I want to go into medical school after.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
That's Dennis Zhang, winner of this year's High School Essay Contest, sponsored by the Sacramento Chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. Also with us, Catherine Jeffrey, president of Sacramento City College and one of the judges of this year's contest. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Gas Hole. It's a new documentary about oil prices and alternative fuels. This is Insight from KXJZ. We'll be right back. This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On tomorrow's Insight, a Sacramento aerospace company. Yes, you heard that right. Plus, in the 60s, Wendy Cook prepared dinner for luminaries like John Lennon and Paul McCartney. She now owns a farm in Spain and writes books about the ethics of food and so-called biodynamic nutrition. Gas Hole is a new documentary about oil prices and alternative ways of powering cars. One of the film's two makers is a Turlock man, and part of the film unfolds in the Modesto area. Gas Hole gets its Sacramento premiere tonight. Joining me are filmmakers Scott Roberts, he's the one from Turlock, and Jeremy Wagner, who lives in LA. Scott, Jeremy, welcome to Insight.
Well, thank you very much for having us. We appreciate it.
Scott, why did you call the film Gas Hole? It's meant to be a little in your face, I guess.
Well, it is in your face, but the truth of the matter is we interviewed my daughter and my son and just asked them a simple question of, you know, where, how do you get gas? Where do you get, you know, how do you fill up? And it was her way of saying, well, you know, you put the little thing in the gas hole, and that's where it came from. It's innocent as it sounds. It's worked out great for us.
And Jeremy, what inspired the film? Where did the idea come from?
Actually, the film idea started about 2.5 years ago. Scott, who's from the area, had read a letter to the editor in the Modesto Bee from a gentleman who, when he was a teenager in the 40s, had met a man who had invented a water-injected carburetor. And this man had claimed that Shell Oil Company had purchased this patent from him, made him a millionaire, and he could keep the one on this Buick Roadmaster, but could never build another.
And as it happens, we have a clip of this very same gentleman who's in the film, Ken Cundy. And here he is from the film.
The man came to the airfield one day with a 1946 Buick Roadmaster. He had invented a carburetor that was water injected and could get close to 100 miles per gallon. He told us that Shell Oil Company had bought the patent from him, which made him a millionaire. Shell told him he could keep the one on this Buick, but could build no more. Now, the Buick Roadmaster was a very heavy car. Can you imagine what that would save on the lightweight cars of today and our energy consumption? Also, the oil industries would have gone broke. My question, whatever happened to this invention? It's been over 55 years, and I'm sure if it was put on the market with today's technology, it could be even more improved. Sincerely, K.R. Cundy, senior citizen.
That's a clip from the film Gas Hole. It's being shown tonight at the Crass Theater in Sacramento. Scott Roberts, do we ever find out what happened to that invention?
Well, we actually did a lot of research, and the patent that we found that we believe is could very well be the patent that Ken is talking about was not that easy to find because it wasn't really registered as a patent that was supposed to save fuel economy. It was actually registered as a patent to get rid of engine knock. And then in the small print, it said, oh, by the way, we get outstanding fuel economy. And it was in the same area and the same area that Shell had a research center. And we put all the pieces of the puzzle together, you know, found the patents, found the sun, and
How come Shell had a research lab near Modesto?
They were actually testing a bunch of farm chemicals, and that's actually a really good question because that's one of the things that we asked when we were doing the movie is, okay, so here's a guy from this area. How does he get it to Shell, which is it's not an American company, and that's when we found out the research center was there.
Jeremy, in the film, there are these old clips, looks like the 50s, that sort of era of these astonishing these cars getting astonishing mileage. What happened to all these vehicles?
Well, that's really one of the questions that we pose in the film. Part of the idea is looking at these different technologies. We follow three stories that are similar to Ken's that were stories that we could substantiate that we felt like we could have some sort of backup on that seemed like they made sense to us. And so from there, then we take the film, we go to Congress, and we talk to both Democrats and Republicans to find out what's going on in Congress and why. Why, for instance, it's taken 25 years to improve the standards for the miles per gallon for the oil industry, and what's happening there, why we haven't been able to move forward. I don't know if most listeners really are aware of it, but fuel economy has gone down since the 80s. We're in the 21st century, and we're getting less fuel economy in our cars than we did when I was in high school in the 90s.
there are all kinds of people in the film, but I don't remember seeing any oil executives being interviewed on camera. We do see them testifying to Congress. Why no one speaking on behalf of the oil industry?
Well, we actually got in contact with all of the oil companies and asked them to please come on camera, and we wanted to find out, you know, what they had planned and what their plans were for the alternative fuel divisions of their companies and what they saw for the next 10 years. But none of them wanted to be on camera. None of them wanted to respond to us. And in fact, in one case, we were put on speakerphone and laughed at.
What do you mean? What happened?
Well, we were talking to the gentleman who was second in command at the alternative fuels division at one of the big major oil companies, and he was in a boardroom. And he'd asked me to call him back because he wanted to hear more about our film. And he put me on speakerphone, and there were a bunch of people in a boardroom. And when they asked what the movie was and what we were wanted to talk to them about, they just started laughing.
Some people, when they hear about your film, they're going to go, just a film made by a bunch of tree-hugging pinkos. But in fact, you aren't.
No, the odd thing about it is we're both registered Republicans. And when we started this film, we come from the narrative world. We're just filmmakers. And this patent idea seemed like a really interesting story. But the more we looked into it, there are so many things that we found that will shock people in this film. And they're things that are in plain sight. They're the level of arrogance and power in this particular industry is so much, and they have such a control over us that people feel helpless, and thereby I think they feel like they can kind of get away with murder.
My guests are Jeremy Wagner, you just heard him, also Scott Roberts. They're the co-makers of the documentary Gashole. It's being shown tonight at the Crest Theater in Sacramento. It's the local premiere of the film. The narrator of the film is the well-known actor, Peter Gallagher. How did your budget extend to Peter Gallagher?
Well, actually, we're both good friends of Melinda Clark, who was on the TV show The O.C. She played Misha Barton's mom on the show. And so she introduced us to Peter, and Jeremy and I went to his house, and we told him about the movie, and he was just fired up and said, absolutely, just call me whenever, and we'll get it done. So,
after you'd gone through all the work in making the film, how did you feel at the end of it? Did you feel hopeful? Did you feel depressed, angry?
Oh, I think we felt all of those things. And for us, what was very important is, as we showed this to people to get a response to it, is at the end of the film, people are really emotionally fired up about it. They want to know what they can do. And we discuss a number of things that you can do in companies that are trying to solve the problem. And so what we felt was really important was to take this film on tour. This is our fifth stop on a 43-city tour. And if you want to follow us or find where we're going to be, we have a website, gasholemovie.com. And at the end of each screening, we're doing a question and answer to give people an opportunity to talk about things that maybe we don't touch on in the film, or to elaborate on things that they feel are important. And to also to find out what's going on in the local communities, because that's really where the solution has to start, is in your local community, is finding out what's happening and what businesses are, what entrepreneurs are trying to solve the problem, and help support those friends and neighbors of yours.
I checked out the your tour itinerary, and you're going all over the country. Wouldn't it be simpler just to try and get a distributor to release it in, 100 movie theaters nationwide at the same time?
Well, we talked about that and we took some meetings, but we thought that because of the subject matter and the topic, we thought it would be more beneficial to actually take it to the people. Like Jeremy said, do the screenings, do the Q&As, get kind of a grassroots buzz about the film, which is what we've been doing so far. The response has been fantastic. And then in September, we're going to release the film in the Big Ten markets. But we just thought it was important to bring it to the people.
The other thing that's important about this is that in as many of the cities as possible, we're trying to not only make some of our money back on this, because it's almost entirely self-financed, but in addition, we're still trying to raise money for local organizations that are solving the problem. For instance, tonight, this is part of the proceeds are going to go towards the Environmental Council of Sacramento. So while we're here, we're trying to help raise money to help solve the issue in Sacramento.
You must be burning a lot of gasoline, though, as you drive from Kentucky to Ohio to North Carolina to Alabama.
Well, actually, when we started the movie, I drove a big truck. And, you know, once my eyes were opened, I'm driving a little fuel-efficient little Honda Civic that gets almost 40 miles per gallon.
And in some of the cities, for instance, we were in Tucson last week, and we rented a flex fuel Chevy Impala, and they, fortunately, they actually have ethanol stations there. They have more ethanol stations, for example, in Tucson than we have in all of California. But where we can, we're doing what we can, and that's, you know, part of our point.
And one other thing stood out for me in your tour itinerary. You're at the Palms Casino in Vegas on May 12th. Are the Maloof family interested in the film?
Yes, actually, they helped Joe Girard over there at the Brendan Theaters in the Palms help set this up for us, and it's going to be a fantastic event. It's the same time that General Motors has their alternative fuels conference going on in Vegas, so we hope to pull a lot of people out of there to see the movie.
Very good. That's Scott Roberts, along with Jeremy Wagner, their co-director, co-producer, co-writers of the documentary Gas Hole. It's being shown tonight at the Crest Theater in Sacramento as part of its nationwide tour. Scott, Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight.